Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
On the way up, when you have more oil coming out of the ground, the economy is easier. Jobs are easier, opportunities, you can make mistakes and recover, all of that's easier. On the way down the slope, we find it's harder, mistakes are more costly.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
All right. So just came out of 5 nights backcountry in Yellowstone. So I look like a homeless guy because of the beard. I think I'm going to give it a go, see if it works. So you're very much among the few. You're very lucky to be in this room today, because I'm going to tell you about the biggest story that just isn't being told right now. Now, I've been talking about this thing called peak oil for a while, right? And by the way, if you've read about it or followed it, you understand that, well, it's a prophecy that went wrong. Peak oil is it's a myth. You've heard potentially that it's been debunked again. This is the narrative structure that's out there in the news. Now, when the narrative has the narrative wrong, that's when your best investment opportunities actually exist, right? Cheap oil is a myth. Doomberg, he and I have a nice long-running sort of a conversation about this. Well, you might have even read it's dead, right? Look at this. Michael Clare, big oil analyst, says there is this theory that holds that there's no physical limit to the global supply of oil. None. From one of the most respected oil analysts out there, says there's no physical limit. How could that be? Technology. Uh-oh. It turns out that this idea of peak oil is back. And this has some of the largest, most profound implications for our future of anything you're going to hear about. And the reason is, this is what peak oil is. It looks like this, right? This is a production curve. This is for the entire globe. The blue line is actual history, and the red line is the projections of where we're going. Now, why does this matter? Because, we're going to have AI. Well, AI doesn't produce energy. It consumes energy enormously. So the question is, where does the energy come from to replace this stuff? Do we have it? Do we have some secret patent sold off that nobody knows about? Has Area 51 got, some crash Roswell stuff in it? We don't know. We have to go with the data we have. So the data we have says that this oil thing is really, really important. Now, here's why this really shocks me, because this, I would have been talking about this for 10 years. This is a slow motion train wreck. We can see it coming. And if I was going to belong to a state, I've never been really living there, but I'm a Missouri guy. Show me. I need to see where the next energy is going to come from, energy as a source, before I'm willing to say this isn't going to be a problem, if not a predicament. Well, the room just got a little bit noisier because it's not some random internet dude anymore. The annual energy outlook from the EIA came out April of this year. And in there, buried, if you had sharp eyes and you took a peek, you saw this chart. They put this in there. Total energy production for crude and condensate. Whoa. Let me highlight this. They announced that we're hitting a peak in the United States. This is big, giant news. It's going to turn us from a net exporter of oil into a net importer of oil very, very rapidly. That changes everything. We're going to have to spend money to import oil again from areas of the world that are highly contested. This puts us in direct conflict with China, who's the number one importer of oil, bar none. And this is going to be a giant phase change. I can't believe that this wasn't bigger news. We got a couple little articles, right? We got Reuters said, it fades. Shale boom fades. This is not nearly as dramatic as it ought to be. I don't know why this isn't catching more attention, but it's a huge phase shift. And it's not like it's just sort of snuck up on us, right? This is oil production in the blue bars, and you can clearly see that it has been trending lower and lower for years. So this moment didn't exactly catch me by surprise or anybody who's looking at it. But the narrative structure that's out there that you will only read about says, well, we're very clever. We'll just unlock more. The United States, if you took it as a single map and mapped every oil well that's been put into it,
There's over 6 million holes on that map now. So by the process of Braille, we've sort of figured out where everything is. And shale represents the source rock that we had our first oil coming out, the cheap stuff. Shale is more expensive, obviously, because you have to drill down 10,000 feet-ish, usually, and go sideways for up to 20,000 more feet on the biggest ones, and then tow it off and do 100-stage fracs or 50-stage fracs, all super expensive. It's fine, but there's nothing below that. That's called the parent rock. There's no such thing as grandparent rock in this story. That's the original shale basin stuff. So that's what we've been seeing. Now, is just back in 2020, the EIA was projecting that we would hit a peak sort of at 2035. Now they dialed that back to 2027. I think you're going to see where this story is going. See that peaking around 2035? Well, now we just look at this short-term energy outlook that just came out in July. So pretty recent data here. And in there, they snuck this little chart in. Here's their newest forecast as of July. And now you can see that actually we're peaking in, well, 2025. Maybe 2026, somewhere in that zone. So it's coming back. Now, I invest in oil wells, shale wells in particular. I can tell you very clearly that all this talk about how they can make money at $60 a barrel is not true. You can make some in some tier one, really high quality areas, but generally speaking, you need a lot more than that for the all-in sustaining cost of production. So they're dialing back. You read all the majors are dialing back their capital. And so we're going to have fewer and fewer wells drilled. Now, the mysterious part about this, the whole time this has been happening, where we can see, you know, this is oil's a commodity. What drives a commodity? Supply and demand. And that gives you price, right? Your supply-demand price curve. Weirdly, oil's been in a sustained two-year downtrend. You think, God, we're swimming in this stuff. That's why prices go down, supply and demand. Must be we just have tons of supply. And if you were invested in, say, the XLE, the energy sector, it's gone nowhere. It's dead money for 3 years, three plus years. So that must mean that all of the collective wisdom of all the investors are just looking at this and they're all yawning and saying there's nothing exciting here. And I don't understand that. So let's go into this. Let's take a forecast real quick. This is one of the most powerful charts I have. And it shows GDP on the y-axis mapped against oil consumption. In every one of those dots is a country. So you map the GDP of a country, you map its oil production consumption, and you find that there's a straight line relationship. And in economics, you never get charts this good, right? The R squared for your math guys out there is like 95.95. Like if you said, Chris, I'm gonna tell you how much oil a country consumes with 95% accuracy, I can tell you how big their economy is. So it's really tight. Okay, so we know there's a direct relationship between oil and an economy. Now that makes sense, right? You know, if you put on energy goggles and take the other, you know, just I live in a city goggles off, you put on your energy goggles and you see all those trucks and all those cars and you get stuck in traffic jams with the energy goggles on, you understand that's all oil being consumed. When you order something and it comes on cross on a boat with bunker fuel and it lands at California port, it gets put on a truck and it gets to Missouri and then it gets to New York and then you buy it in the store, oil, 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 oil. That's how we move stuff, 100%. 70% of oil is actually used to move stuff. 30% is for other pharmaceuticals, plastics, asphalt, things like that. But 70% is used to move stuff. And 95% of all the things that move do so because of oil. Electric cars, are electric transport at this point is a negligible rounding error in this story. So if you want to understand the economy, you have to understand oil. And that's why this chart looks so brilliant. GDP against oil. So the first thing you should be thinking right away is, well, if our economy needs to be bigger to support, in the United States, we now have $103 trillion of debt in our debt markets overall. That all has to be paid back. When's it going to get paid back? In the future. From what? The future economy. How much oil are we going to have in the future? Will it be there? That would be the operative question to have. So I said I'm going to make a forecast. First up, what we're looking at here is a chart of total oil production in the United States. Starting from, I can't read the left side of that, but it's probably 1900 or so. And you can see that that big green wedge in the bottom, that's called conventional oil. This is where you stick a straw straight into the ground and oil comes out, usually under pressure. And then when the pressure goes away, you put one of those little bobbing donkey things on it, you know, that pulls it up, a pump jack. Notice that that green stuff peaked in 1970 and has not ever gone back up above that level. That's conventional. That's AKA cheap oil. That stuff came out of the ground at $1 or $2 a barrel. And it's not because we didn't have curiosity. It's not because we didn't punch holes in the ground. It's not really because of regulations. If oil is there, trust me, it gets pulled out of the ground. It's because we ran out of conventional oil fields. Well, then we have that blue smear on top, right? And that's the Gulf of Mexico. That came on. That's nice stuff. And then you have yellow, which is Alaska. That came on board. But between 1970 and 1973, oil basically went from $3 a barrel to $33 a barrel. It went up, like imagine if today it went from $60 a barrel to $600 a barrel. You're like, wow, they'd start drilling. Lots would come out of the ground. Well, they did. We went from 995 rigs in 1970 to over 4,800 drill rigs by 1973, and still less came out of the ground. Now, why is that? It's because geology. It just, the conventional oil wasn't there. Well, then shale came along. True miracle. I invest in it. I think the technology is amazing. I think the people who drill for it are astonishing. Does anybody watch Landman? You know, great show. So this is tight oil as of 2023 in red. That's shale oil. It came out. It's amazing. So often you'll see this chart. They just show you the top line. They don't show you the colors. You just go, oh, we had a peak once, and then we had, yeah, that went away. It must have been peak oil's dead. It's a myth. It's dead. It's a stupid idea. Well, now that we know that shale oil is going to peak, I did my level best in it, Microsoft Paint or whatever stupid program I used to project the future, and it looks like this. And the question is, okay, fine. It's not the end of the world, but now we're competing for oil on the open market, and there isn't that much for sale because we don't actually care how much any country produces. We care how much is available for export. And that's the story that really needs to be talked about right now. That's the future. This is everything on the way up. When you have more oil coming out of the ground, the economy is easier. Jobs are easier, opportunities, you can make mistakes and recover. All of that's easier. On the way down the slope, we find it's harder, it's more tricky. What do you do? Mistakes are more costly. I don't think Luke Groman was here, but when I interviewed him last, he said that when you look at the amount of debt in the world, his analysis suggested that $100 trillion of U.S. debt could afford maybe $90 a barrel oil, but then that market starts to implode. This data is suggesting you haven't, could we see a 10x in the price of oil over the next 5-10 years? And the answer is yes, if it repeats the 70s, absolutely. Could our debt market survive that? No. Can people who stretched and bought a house really far out in the exurbs, so they have to commute using their F-150 to get there, can they afford $10, $15, $20 a gallon gas? The answer is no. So there's a lot of things that have an implication around this.
Hello, Dr. Chris Martinson here, and I just want to say we're at the peak. Peak oil, peak debt, peak denial. The systems we've leaned on are buckling, and most folks are sleepwalking through it. But not me. At Peak Prosperity, I'm wide awake, scouring the globe for the signals, web data, news, firsthand accounts, piecing together what's next. I've been wrong before, and I'll admit it, but I'm relentless about getting it right. This is your wake-up call. The future's not waiting. Subscribe now to get the insights that thousands of others already enjoy. Join the prepared. And let's turn uncertainty into opportunity. Peak Prosperity's where it starts.
We are in a really weak starting position, so I can't explain the weak price of oil. This is looking at how much oil the United States has in storage, and that blue line is recent history, and that grayish bars, you see, that's so-called five-year range. Over the past 5 years, the highest and the lowest positions are marked by the upper and lower boundaries of that gray smear. Where are we today? Well, we're all the way at the bottom of that range, and we're going to set a new low for oil inventories. Biden sold off our so-called strategic petroleum reserve, which turned out to be a political petroleum reserve, and sold it off. And so that top, the blue solid line, don't look at the bars, those might be confusing, but you can see that we used to have about 750 million barrels in strategic reserve, and now we've got 407 or something like that. So we don't have a lot in storage, and also this is true across the entire OECD at this point. We're just coming into this period fairly weak inventories. You'd want to come into a position like this, everything topped off. Editorially, China is topped off. They've really filled up their own SPR and all their storage. So they see this up. Now, what about demand? Because we keep hearing the other side of the story has to be demand. So, oh, we're going to have peak oil demand. I've been hearing this for 10 years. And for 10 years, we always consume more oil globally than last year. And so this is also from that annual energy outlook. And I call this the ACM chart. This is we're always consuming more. So here they're looking at what they think the average daily consumption is going to be going forward for the globe, 102 million barrels. Well, maybe that goes up to 103, and it's up to 103.8 and 104. We're always going to be consuming more. This has always been true. Please beware when you hear that there's such a thing as peak oil demand because electric cars, it just hasn't materialized in the data yet. Again, show me. I need to see it. Hasn't happened yet. And I don't really think it can because when you devolve it, even if we said, snap your fingers tonight, all cars are electric cars magically somehow, how much less oil are we going to consume? And the answer is zero less many barrels. Why? Because we need all the other oil that comes out for the other stuff, the asphalt and the pharmaceuticals and the plastics and the diesel. The gasoline would be a byproduct at that point. Probably have to burn it or turn it into Bitcoin. I don't know. And now we have to talk about China because there's one other aspect to the story that's really ginormous. And if you've been following the AI story, it's really, there's some concern sort of culturally, what does this mean? What does this mean for jobs? You know, NAFTA stole blue collar jobs, right? Because all the Maytag, you know, assemblers and the Detroit assemblers, all those jobs went to Mexico. AI is going to destroy white collar jobs. It's taken away coders. It's taken away lawyers. It's going to take away CPAs. That's already happening. It's not a future state. Microsoft fired 700 junior lawyers the other day. Don't need them. AI does a better job writing initial briefs. AI, looked at from my perspective, is a story of energy. These things are energy hogs, and they're going to consume a lot of electricity, and they are already doing that. I just read this morning in Jeff Childers' Coffee and COVID, if anybody hasn't read, that's great, great Substack. He said that in Texas last year, AI consumed 493 million gallons of water while people were being fined for watering their lawns. So AI is already taking precedence over green lawns. AI is more important than humans. This year, it's projected to consume 49 billion gallons of water. So we got water issues. So if you're planning and you're in real estate, you're going to have to look forward on the water demand issue very carefully around AI. This is one of these disruptive things. The internet was transformative. AI is disruptive. We don't have a cultural model for what do you do when a whole bunch of white-collar jobs go away, right? We do not need McKinsey and Bain and Booz Allen consultants anymore. AI already will section all of that, does a great job, marketing, plan, structuring, you all know that, right? So if AI is fundamentally a question of electricity, and electricity gets us into the oil story a little bit because the way we do peak demand here in the United States for electricity is natural gas. This is probably the most important chart I have. You will notice the United States is producing about 4,000 terawatt hours of electricity per year. China crossed that mark in 2010, and then in the next 10 years added another 4,000 terawatt hours of electricity production, and in the last 5 years has added another 2,000 terawatt hours. They are now producing more electricity than the whole rest of the world combined, including the United States. And China is building the Three Gorges Dam, if you've heard of it, is the largest engineering miracle in the world. It's so large, it actually perceptibly altered the rotation of the Earth. They are now currently constructing a dam three times larger than that. They're slapping in nuclear plants as fast as they know how. They're building coal-fired plants two a week. They're building thorium nuclear reactors. China is all over this because they understand the future belongs to those who have an appropriate energy infrastructure to manufacture, to run AI, and to conduct business. The United States is not ready for this, and we're slapping a lot of AI for water and electricity demand. So prediction would be, oh, well, electricity costs are going to go up quite a lot, potentially, 2x and 3x. Right? Who's noticed that electricity has gone up a lot just in the last 2-3 years? It has because of this AI story, so this is a derivative part of the story. Germany has phased out all of its nuclear plants. China is going the absolute opposite direction. This is what happens when you have broken narratives. Germany is pursuing a green energy policy. It's going to be the death of them. They are no longer going to be a competitive manufacturing nation. That's where their wealth came from. Energy is prosperity. If you have it, you can have prosperity. You can still screw it up, but at least you have the chance. China gets it. The West is going the exact opposite direction, making it really hard on ourselves to produce reliable, stable, cheap electricity. UK, screwed. All of Europe, I think, is just basically really upside down in this story. But that chart right there tells you who owns the future. Clear as day. So I did say I want to talk about natural gas, too, as a derivative of this thing. We have a lot of natural gas in the United States. We've got a ton. The Marcellus field, which, you know, is a few states in the east. If that was a country, it would be the third largest gas-producing country in the world. It's a really big deal. So there's a lot there, but for whatever reason, over the past year, total natural gas production has only gone up by 0.6 billion cubic feet per day. So what's the implication? Well, we're going to have to drill a lot of wells. You know why? Because it's going to get really crazy how much electricity demand is going on for this stuff, right? Here, we're looking at how much we are exporting in LNG. So right up through January 2025, I think you can see the direction here. Remember, natural gas production only went up by 0.6 BCF. Here, over this time frame, it went from 8 billion cubic feet per day to about 14. And that's going to go up a lot. Trump came in, signed a bunch of stuff that Biden had on hold. We have 6 new LNG trains going in. There's enormous amount of natural gas demand coming forward. And by the way, the projection is that the United States is going to need 45 billion cubic feet per day more natural gas by 2035. Exclamation point. We only produce about 100 billion cubic feet per day. So it's like a 40, 45% increase. Where's that going to come from? If you're in this space, this is going to come from a lot of midstream companies, drilling companies, producing companies, lease. There's just this, I don't have a path for how we get that much more out of the ground, but that's where demand is. So remember the price demand supply curve. If the demand is 45, but the supply is only 30, say, what happens? Well, price. Price has to go up a lot to bring demand back down to what actual supply is. And in that same annual energy outlook, there were so many bonus charts in there, I had to dig for them. By the way, this is just astonishing if you're in this space at all. I don't have a plan for how we get there. They projected total energy production in the United States going from here to, what's that, 2050? What do you see? I see flat lines. Like, this is how much energy they could reasonably concoct that we could get from all different sources, right? So we have natural gas in there. Oil, hydropower, nuclear, biomass, coal, everything you could think of, anything that's a source of energy, and it's dead flat. The consumption demands for AI is anything but flat. It's now exponential. Elon Musk really impresses me. I was kind of a critic at first, but, you know, he gave us self-driving cars and worldwide global internet satellite. He caught giant spaceships with tweezers, so... He also started in the AI space just a few years ago, and he's already number, as far as I'm concerned, number one in the world at it right now. And he's building he built the Colossus 1 data center, which is massive, and now he's building the Colossus 2, which is extra massive, as something like 50 million H100 units. I don't even know what that means, but, you know, the NVIDIA units. 50 million of those. It's going to consume, that Colossus 2 will literally consume as much electricity as Denver. That one data center. So where does that come? That's extra demand on here. We're already using 100% of our power. So AI is going to start competing. Now, I think this has to be factored into everybody's thought processes because utilities are about to become meaningful for people in a way that they haven't in a very long time. So dead flat. So what do we do with this? Some paths forward. Path forward number one would be, well, we're going to do something. We're going to be clever monkeys, and we're going to have some huge productivity advancement. It's going to allow more oil and natural gas to come out of the ground somehow in ever-rising quantities at the same price. As an investor in that, please go talk to people who are in this space. We're down to incremental percentage changes, right? We're not getting 100% productivity gains. If we can get a 3% gain or 4, 2, that's where we're at in this story. It's a very mature industry. We're seeing consolidation across the shale space, right? Exxon and Chevron buying smaller operators. That's called a mature industry. So we're at the mature stage of the story, we're not at the beginning. We're closer to the beginning of the end, you know, than we are at the beginning of the beginning. And so this is, I discount this one pretty heavily. So I would call this the miracle path. It might happen. I never discount anything to zero, but I have just low single-digit percentages on this one. Path two would be oil and natural gas have to rise in price by a lot to justify more massive capital infusions that we need to get more out of the ground. Now, what would that be? To get a little technical about it, in any shale play or oil play of any kind, there's a sweet spot. And they find that sweet spot again by Braille. They start poking holes and like, whoa, look at the flow rates over here. And guess what? All that is called tier one, the core acreage. That gets drilled out first. We're out of tier one acreage in every single shale space except for the Permian, which is close. And the Permian is that big play in Texas and New Mexico. And actually, we can isolate this down. There are only two counties, Lee and Eddy counties, that are actually still increasing their production. So the Permian play is actually a story of two counties, one in New Mexico, one in Texas. We're down to just those two. And they're already starting to show increasing what's called gassiness, more gases coming out of the ground than before on a ratio basis to oil. So again, those plays are still producing more, but they're also nearing the end. And the question becomes, well, what happens then? We saw that it doesn't run out. Peak oil is not a story of, oh, it's over on Tuesday, I guess. We're just gonna get less and less and less and less out of the ground. From this point going forward, everybody who's young in this room, this is a totally different landscape than the one I grew up in. It's just, the rules are different. You can do anything you want when you have ample energy, right? I kind of think of this like the Easter Island story. It's like, go for it, build giant stone heads, face them east, you know? I'm a little worried that AI is sort of like our stone heads, right? Oh, we got to get these. We have to win this race. And by the way, it's not so that you can do a cute query and come up with a better introduction or a snappy, like, you know, picture of a cat, you know, in a swimming pool. AI is an existential race for our country, which is worried about something called the digital canyon, meaning that if China gets to AGI and then SGI, two terms, you know, artificial general intelligence and then super general intelligence, they get there first, we'll never catch up because their models will be advancing themselves at a pace that's always in front of us. And the worry is that whoever loses that race loses the world. So that's why we're just throwing everything at this. The problem is we're doing it all from the side of build the AI as fast as possible. And I kid you not, nobody is looking at the energy side of the story. I had hopes, Chris Wright, the new energy secretary, he actually sits on the board of OCLA, a small modular nuclear reactor company, and he owned a fracking company. If anybody should know what the heck the story is, it's him. And I'm not seeing the signs out there that we're really looking at the supply side of the energy story at all. And this peak oil story should have been the biggest deal ever. If it is sending up alarm bells, they're keeping them really hidden. Like, I'm not reading about this anywhere. And it's bizarre, because that is probably the most strategically important thing that could happen to a country. Or not. So path three is, well, oil and natural gas prices kind of rise uncontrollably to a level that bursts the debt bubble that's been operating since, well, August 15, 1971. And everything you think you know about the capital markets and everything I think I know is wrong. And that means that we run a risk of something like the great taking machinery being activated. If you don't know what the great taking refers to, that's David Rogers Webb work talking about the legal constructs that have been put in place to enable Wall Street to seize all of our assets under certain circumstances. Came in the construct of the great financial crisis, scared Wall Street a little bit. I did a whole series on this. So if you want to know more about that, come check me out. I'll point you, or Nick can point you to where to find that. But it's important stuff to understand. Just understand they haven't pulled the trigger on that legal machinery, but there could be circumstances where it might get pulled. And so understanding it as a risk to your wealth is actually really important. And so inflation is path two. Resilience is what I talk about a lot, and I think we should all be resilient. That's what it all leads to resilience. What's resilience? Resilience is that you have a buffer. Nick thinks about it as, you know, it's the difference between jumping out of a plane and jumping out of a plane with a parachute. It just gives you buffer. It slows things down. So resilience cuts across a lot of topics. And so financial freedom, financial wealth, financial resilience is important. But none are so poor as those who only have money. You're going to need skills. You're going to need to think about the safety and security of your family. You're going to need to think about your emotional and spiritual resilience. These are going to be very trying times if what I've presented is true. If there's some part of this story I haven't gotten wrong. And believe me, I ask myself with Nick every day, how do we have this wrong, Nick? And I keep looking for it, and I can't find it, and that bothers me. Because that's usually when you do have it wrong. But I keep poking at this, and I can't, unless the base data is fundamentally just totally, been corrupted. This is the story we have. And as an investor in oil and gas wells, I'm pretty sure this is right. There's only so many places to poke holes in the ground. There's only so much stuff that comes out of any one well. And you can calculate where you want to go. Now, the mysterious part about this story is that China released 2 years ago a 5-point energy plan that read like they understood all this data. They're only going to bring alternative energy on, solar, wind, at 1% per year, capping it at 12%, because anything faster or anything larger than that leads to grid instability, which they're facing in Europe now because they rammed that up to 25% in Germany. And then, 2 years ago, they had an eclipse went right across Germany, and that was just, it just killed solar production in this like really weird hole that went across the country, and it totally disrupted their grid. Did anybody hear about Spain this year? Spain also went really high on their alternative energy percentage, and they had a nationwide grid down that's unstable. If you're running an aluminum foundry and your grid goes out, that stuff solidifies in the channels, and you're not getting that plant up and running for a long time. Right? Grid stability is really important. So China said, yeah, we'll cap it at 12. They're building nuclear, hydro, all the stuff I talked to you about. But most importantly, they said one of the fifth element in their story was, hey, we're going to have to make friends with countries that can sell us oil. And so they're out there pursuing checkbook diplomacy, right? And we just bombed, I can't believe we did this. We bombed Iran's nuclear facilities, kind of opening that door saying, oh, that's a cool, you can do that if it makes sense to you. But anyway, we didn't make a lot of friends in one of the key areas that has a lot of oil left to produce. So this is the geopolitical implications of this are large. I hope it doesn't end in a shooting war, but almost every war in history has been a resource war. So that's why resilience. Now, a few predictions off of this, for whatever it's worth. Okay, first, unless we have a global recession, depression, whatever you call it, unless we have something like that that really kills oil demand, we're going to have actual shortages in the world within 2 to 3 years. And that just means prices are going to go higher. How much, how fast, can't predict. Markets are crazy. They overshoot, they undershoot, they do what they do. But higher is the prediction. Further, the U.S., unless we like open up the East Coast and the West Coast to drilling and we find stuff right away, we're going to be a net importer of oil again forever. Now, there might be more oil out there, but we're going to have to get there, and we're going to have to find it, and we're going to have to get there quick. Because if we start drilling off the East Coast, say, and we find a lot of oil out there with a 2-inch test bore, it'll be 7 years before that field would be producing maximally, because it just takes time. You got to put in the pipelines, the drill rigs, the manifolds, all that stuff. It just takes time. AI demand for natural gas, mostly, generate electricity, it's going to create a perfect storm for much higher natural gas prices and electricity prices. And by 2030, according to all my data, this becomes really apparent. But you're going to have to start factoring that in to your calculations You know, Kenny this morning was talking about some of the things that, of all the things he can and can't control, was operating costs that were starting to eat into his storyline, and in particular because insurance costs went up. Right? So that happened. Well, electricity utility costs are going to be a new part of that story coming in, worth checking out. And then once peak oil is actually a matter of what's called common knowledge, then national dynamics will shift. Some countries will say, sure, maybe I shouldn't export this anymore. I'm going to hoard it, whatever. Norway may decide we don't need any more digits representing a sovereign wealth fund. We just need the oil. So we may see some hoarding, some more pinches to come in on the export side. So common knowledge, for those who aren't familiar with that idea, private knowledge, right now we all share private knowledge. Everybody in this room has private knowledge that we all share of everything I just presented. You know it, you know it, you know it. Common knowledge occurs when everybody knows that everybody knows something. And the story around this is Harvey Weinstein. Everybody knew what it meant if Harvey Weinstein called a young starlet into his office, right? They all knew what was going to happen, but they knew it privately. You knew it, you knew it, you knew it. We all knew it privately. So he was still, you know, he got invited to parties, he went places. And then one day Rose McGowan comes out and says, he's a rapey guy. And everybody's like, oh, now everybody knew that everybody knew the same information they already held privately, but everything shifted. He's no longer invited to parties. He goes to prison. He's shunned. All that stuff happens. Nothing changed in the data anybody held about him before and after, except common knowledge is when everybody knows that everybody knows the same thing. The most astonishing thing I've seen is that when I'm saying this stuff, people are like, ah, yeah, maybe. But now you can go into Grok. I would challenge you, punch any of this stuff in. Go in. Go into any one of ChatGPT. Punch all this data in. Hey, Grok, this weird guy Chris said that there might be a peak of oil. You know, what do you think? And what would the implications be? And it'll spit out this whole same analysis for you, which means that anybody else could do that, which means we're, AI accelerates common knowledge coming forward, because now you go, well, if I could type that in, anybody could. So it's kind of like everybody knows, has the chance. This has been the most astonishing thing, to watch the common knowledge development explode around this. So things could change very quickly. We are a narrative species. Once the narrative changes, the behavior changes. It's almost never from the data. It's from the stories. So I showed a lot of data. But the narrative structure of this whole thing now is changing very, very rapidly. AI is accelerating that. It's also, you know, it's like any technology, some pros, some cons. And it's going to do some things for us, but the impact it's going to have on our energy demand is absolutely, I don't know if anybody's planning for it. I don't see it. If they are, again, they're keeping it super well hidden. So at any rate, that's the whole story I have for you right there. Thank you very much. We got 6 minutes for questions. If anybody has any questions, I'm going to just keep babbling while Nicole runs back for the microphone. But thank you very much.
Hey, Chris, you talked about this briefly, but is there any chance that we can find domestic oil at enough, fast enough, that might change this equation? Let me mention 7 years that we can find it, but is there any hope?
It's possible. There's some up in Alaska. There is a strategic petroleum reserve up there, in essence, that we haven't drilled out, but it's right in Anwar, and it takes the National Wildlife Refuge, and so it might be tricky to get there. And so the problem with that is, I was talking with a guy who make these things called man camps, right? Because you have to have all these workers. In Alaska, you have to bring everything with you. And he said, here's the deal, Chris. We go to Anwar. We either have to make ice roads in the winter and do the whole ice truck road thing, or we have to go up the coast because everything else is boggy. So we have to go up the coast because we can make gravel roads that would be year-round. So A, we have to build about 700 miles of road. Expense number one. Two, we have to build these man camps, and he's the company that does that, because oil companies aren't fully integrated. They have these companies that build them. It requires lavatories, ping pong areas, sleeping quarters, you know, all the stuff. So they bring him in, and he said he has to be able to get his money back in 5 years, so the oil company has to sign a five-year deal. So he's all excited, because Trump said, we're going to open up Anwar, and he goes to talk to the oil companies. They said, yeah, but what if he gets voted out? That's only in 3 years. And we have to make a five-year investment, and might all go to zero. So the political risk alone is holding that back right now. Nobody knows how to drill off the East Coast or West Coast at this point. So all we really have is the terrestrial stuff in the lower 48. And the answer is, the chance of us finding a big find in there, like I said, is really low. Possible, but it's unlikely at this point.
Hey, Chris, you're trading Arlington results. I think you said at the beginning of the session that Doomberg or the X, that Ecoil, Ansa, did that right?
The who?
Doomberg.
Yeah. Yeah, he does.
What's the core of his thesis in that?
Well, one of his core rejections is just the past is the future is just going to resemble the past, right? We've always managed to find a way, so we will continue to. When I pressed him on that and said, please point specifically on the map to where that magic's going to happen, he then went to the second layer of the argument. He said, oh, well, there's this Pearl natural gas to liquids facility, right, where they take natural gas and it's natural gas is a single carbon molecule, carbon four hydrogens, that's it, methane. And they take it at this Pearl facility out near Qatar and they turn it into oil. It's called gas to liquids. It's a GTL plant. He said, look, we could just put these GTL plants up. We'd only need 7 of them in the United States to meet our needs. But the thing is that one GTL plant cost $20 billion to build a while ago. And it's in a field that they couldn't otherwise get to market. So it has a dedicated field and is pulling massive amounts out. So if you took 2 units of energy of gas, you get 1 unit of diesel or, you know, liquid petroleum at the back end. So it's very energy inefficient. So my question next to him, which was, please point to which gas field isn't already 100% contractually delivering so that you could take 100% of it and dedicate it to this plant instead of that. And that's where the conversation stopped. Because again, I'm a show me guy. Technically you can do this, but the question is you have to have a massive, super massive, long duration gas field that nobody else has tapped into yet or isn't otherwise contractually obligated. Because when they put all this stuff in and put it in the pipeline, there's already a buyer for it. Like we don't just pull it out and have it just like kicking around. So that's the problem I have is that we don't have any identified place where we could do that. But if we got smart about it, we might be able to say, well, we'll start drilling more in our natural gas fields and there's a ton in there. And we're going to use that to actually transport cars. So propane cars or natural gas cars are actually pretty cool. The octane is like 180. The engines last for 500,000-600,000 miles. It would be astonishing. But again, like what you're hearing about with the reserve currency from Snyder and the network effects from George, it takes time to build that network up. You know, they don't just appear because you say, well, let's use compressed natural gas for cars. Like there's a whole industry that has to sort of stand up around that. So we're not on that path. We could, but we're not there.
I'm just curious, I have a question about how technology is going to change our search for oil as well. I mean, is it true that there is technology now where whatever's in the ground where you can actually see by standing? Like, is there that much mystery oil left then because we have that technology? Like, where, you know, ways, places would he?
Yes, elsewhere in the world, possibly maybe Africa. United States has been completely mapped gravitationally, 3D seismic, you name it. So I'm pretty confident the U.S. has been mapped. Always open to be surprised, but that's how I understand it. And we have 30 seconds left because I'm going to be on time for Nicole.
One test has argued that the most probable is solar. What do you think about that?
So I love solar. I have it on my house, but solar makes electrons, right? We don't have any way of using electricity for all the other things I mentioned that we use petroleum for, right? You can't go from solar to asphalt. It's not going to happen. And solar also is very diffuse, right? It's very low concentrated energy, meaning, you know, you get 1 watt per meter square, right? 1,000 watts per meter, if you can capture that. But it's very low density energy, and we're going to need really high density energy. There's no way we know about to run a jet on solar at this point in time with a full load of like gold bars going back to Germany. I'm just joking. That never happens. So I'm a fan, but it's very different. It's not a fungible. They call it, it's not a fungible thing. So that's it. Thank you very much, everybody.
Are you able to take one more?
Oh, I am. I was just...
We're pressing, and I'll get
all right. You.
I was just curious about demographics. Like, if you look at China's demographics of the time, have you played that in your math with all this stuff?
In terms of...
In terms of demand, you can kind of fetch the ball of numbers and things like that. I can see, like, China's got disastrous demographics over time. How is that going to weigh into the energy demands and everything else in the math, I guess?
Yeah, that's a slow burn fuse. It could weigh in. I think China might actually get itself more resilient because, are you familiar with the car company BYD? Yes, they make really nice cars. I wish we could buy them. They're illegal here, but in the U.S., land of the free. They're building a 50-square-mile plant right now just to build electric cars. It's a little over 7.5 miles on a side, same size as San Francisco. They're building one fully integrated, gigantic electric car plant because China's going to do as much as it can to electrify its transport, and that'll include the high-speed trains, that'll include the cars, all of that. So there's actually a lot that can be done there. I do believe we're going to push towards electrification, but first you have to build the electricity production and then the distribution before you can get to the demand side. I live in a state, Massachusetts, which requires you to have a 60-amp EV car charger on any new house that's constructed. By law, you have to put it in. So now people have to run 400-amp panels instead of 200, and it's expensive. And we are dismantling our production side rapidly, coal plants, all that. It's just one of the dumbest things I've ever seen. So China has a plan for that stuff, and I do think they would be able to get better because they have, if you go into Beijing now, I was there a long time ago, and it was bicycles, and recently, it's all these different types of electric cars. It's not just like a Tesla supercar. Those things are race cars. They have little trikes, they got scooters, they got little box fans, larger ones, larger. They have all the things for the last mile, last quarter mile, last 100 yards, like all different electrified. So I think that's a great way to push if you can get there, but it's gonna take a lot of planning and we're not quite there yet here, but yeah, it's gonna take time for those demographics to play out.
Awesome, give it up.